The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Olympic Games strain national budgets and infrastructure, and the competition stretch the limits of the human body. But rarely do the Games push the boundaries with political statements. In the 1968 Games, American runners Tommy Smith and John Carlos did. After placing first and third in the men's 200-meter race, the eyes of the world were upon them, standing barefoot on the medals podium when they took a stand.
And in perhaps the most famous gesture in Olympic history, they raised their fists during the national anthem to show solidarity with the civil rights movement.
That's Dave Zirin from the documentary Not Just a Game, describing what is also one of the most iconic images of protest from the civil rights era. The champions forfeited their medals, were kicked off the team, and sent home. Now, Dr. John Carlos is speaking out about the fallout from that seminal moment and the role of athletes as activists. John Carlos, welcome to Word of Mouth.
I'm honored to be here. I might start by correcting you a little bit. You stated that they've taken our medals. This is propaganda and falsities. They've been propagandizing for the last 48 years. They never took our medals. They attempted to intimidate us and tell us they were going to take our medals. And I stepped forward and told them that they had no right to take our medals because they didn't give us any medals. They didn't knock on our door and put us on the victory stand. You know, we had to go through a process of elimination. By the grace of God, we qualified. We went to the Olympic Games. We had to go through a bigger process of elimination. Once again, we was blessed and we qualified as well to be on the victory stand.
Well, I want to hear more about that watershed moment. Why and how did you and Tommy Smith decide you were going to do that? You were going to raise your gloved fists on that podium.
You look at the circumstance in America at that particular time. We was in a crisis situation as far as humanity went. We were concerned about humanity. Everyone liked to cast it as a Black Power salute or Black Power movement. The Black Power movement was within my genes. I had no control over, you know, my genes in terms of ethnically who I am. But what I did have control over was whether I would be speaking for those that was voiceless. And I felt it was necessary to make a statement for those individuals. It was a human rights issue. It wasn't a political issue and definitely wasn't a race issue. It was a human rights issue.
Well, after that moment, what happened in the stadium? What did that feel like to you walking off that podium at that moment?
Well, a couple of elements. You know, we're looking for the sniper because we received so many threats on our lives. So we're listening for the gun because it's that low between initially us making the statement and then them coming out of that mild shock that they had, you know, where they started booing and sissing and doing the things that they were doing. When they started to do that, I kind of smiled to myself and said, mission accomplished, because they could never take back what they had before their eyes. Now the process for them was to examine what was taking place.
Well, so you knew going in that you were going to do that. Do you think that guided your performance in any way, your speed, your sprinting?
Well, I don't think that had too much to do with it at all, you know, other than the fact that I didn't go there to win the gold medal. I went there to set a precedent that I can run if I want to run, but it's my choice. And I choose to, you know, just seek a medal to get on the victory stand. The gold, the bronze, the silver really didn't matter. What mattered was what you saw as that spectacle that day.
But this event did cast you as a rebel, a renegade, you know, anti-American in some kind of way to do that during the national anthem. What was the cost of that to your life?
Oh, you know, it was a negative situation. Employment was very difficult to come by. You know, it was very difficult to keep my family intact, you know, keep my family solid. My kids had to endure, you know, a lot of negatives in the school system. once they were known to be my kids. Just a hard way to go. But I would do it, like I said, 1,000 times over. You know, my first wife took her life as a result of what happened in Mexico City. Mm. But she had to die, and anyone in my family would have had to die 1,000 times over, because I wouldn't add nothing nor take anything away from what I had to do that day, because that was far more important than any of my lives.
Well, how about now, when the civil rights of African Americans and people of color again being raised by a protest movement? We have seen LeBron James, Steph Curry, others at the ESPYs. Serena Williams spoke out at Wimbledon and raised her fist, very much echoing the gesture that you did. A number of tweeted hashtags, Black Lives Matter, ask for prayers for Alton Sterling, Philando Castile.
Those individuals are a fruit of our labor. You know, when you sit back and think about it, you know, Professor Edwards, Professor Carlos, Peter Norman, and Lee Evans as well. We all were gardeners at that particular time, and we tilled the earth and planted the seeds and watered it and so forth. And what you see through these young activists out there now, being an athlete, being an artist, an actor, or what have you, what you see now is the birth child of the 60s.
Mm. You know, we've talked about the tremendous cost on your family and parts of your life. Do you think it is more difficult for athletes today to speak up, you know, in the sports environment that we live in with, you know, these massive multimillion-dollar contracts, public faces of organizations, cities, endorsement deals? Do you think it's harder?
Well, I would think it's a far more easier situation, because if you sit back and gave consideration to the fact that these individuals are corporations within themselves, just based on the bank accounts that they had. So, you know, like if a guy is making $25 million, $30 million, it's not a hard thing for him to step up and be a voice for those that's voiceless, because if they try and dismiss him from whatever his profession is, he still has enough money and enough brain power to create his own business. That's the problem with most people. They have a good thought, but they don't have any capital gain. These individuals have capital gain. So therefore, they should be able to feel free enough to speak on issues that concern them within their environment, within their communities, within their business life, within the kids of their community's life. They have a responsibility to these individual kids. It's not about them always receiving the applause and taking the bows and so forth. By showing their statement, they're showing their respect to the individuals that they left behind in those various communities. I've moved on, but I haven't forgotten you.
But you are retired now, but you were a school counselor for many years. Did people know who you were? Did they know you were that man?
Well, they didn't have a clue when I went to the campus. When I hit the campus, they had some kids that was cutting out of school, and they was in the restaurant making a whole bunch of ruckus. And police came to me and asked me would I like to go to the restaurant to try and round these kids up to get them back in school. And we went in one police car, and the other car was coming around, and the officer told the other car, don't turn your lights on. Well, the other officer thought, he said, turn your lights on. And he come around with his lights, so the kids ran out a side door. So I walked to the front door, and as I'm walking to the front door, they're running through the side door, running across this main street. So I eased through the restaurant, went across the street, and then I started running, because they had started running by that time. And one officer was running after one kid, and I shot by the officer so fast, it shocked him. And I grabbed the kid and told him to hold him. There was three more kids running. And I started running behind them, and they turned the corner. And I said, damn, where'd they go? You know, they couldn't have gone too far because I was right on their bus. And I hear one of the kids in the bushes saying, man, what happened to that old man? He sure can run like hell. And I said to him, all right, guys, come on out from one of there. And they came, man, who are you? And my response to them was, maybe if you was in school, you might have a chance to find out who I am. And lo and behold, these two kids here, three kids, they actually was in a history class 2 years later and saw the picture of the demonstration in the history book. And they noticed my name, and they had a debate or a discussion as to whether that's possibly could be John Carlos. Now, one kid thought it was me, and the other kid said, well, that guy's too young to be Mr. Carlos. So I told him, I said, well, I'll tell you what, y'all going to research it and get back, and we have some dialogue about it.
Let me ask you, that protest from you and Tommy Smith set a precedent, shocked the world. That moment can never be repeated. What do you think?
First of all, the world needed a shock. And that's exactly what we were trying to do, trying to shock them back into reality.
What do you think athletes today could do to even begin to approach seizing of attention for issues that are really important?
Well, first of all, the difference, we in the 60s, we researched and studied the beast that we were dealing with. We had so much ammunition to build the foundation to speak on social issues, to speak on world issues, to speak on humanitarian issues. We studied high and low. So when you come before me with a microphone, it's not like you ask me a question. I'm scratching my head about, why I did what I did. Why I did it at the Olympic Games. I had to have all these answers in this foundation long before I'd gone to Mexico City.
Well, Dr. John Carlos, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. John Carlos, setting the record straight. He is the Olympic athlete who won the bronze medal in the 1968 Summer Games in the 200 meter and, along with Tommy Smith, raised his gloved fist in a protest gesture that has become truly iconic. You can find links to more about John Carlos at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At the turn of the 20th century, the North Pole was one of the last uncharted sites remaining on Earth. Parties of explorers set out, only to be turned back or killed, attempting to plant their flags at the top of the world. We're not going to jump into the dispute over whether another expedition beat him to it. Instead, we'll focus on the man who was with him, an African-American explorer named Matthew Henson, who may actually have been the first to set foot on the terrestrial North Pole. Brian Clark Howard is a senior writer for National Geographic who marked what would have been the 150th birthday of Matthew Henson. Brian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what do we know about the origins of Matthew Henson, born 150 years ago this month?
Yeah, so Matthew Henson actually had a challenging early life, and he really overcome a lot of obstacles. He was born to a family of black sharecroppers in rural Maryland, and at an early age, he became an orphan. First, his mother died, then his father remarried and had a few more kids, and then, tragically, his father passed away when Matthew Henson was still quite young. So at first, he was sent to live with an uncle in Washington, D.C., and things went pretty well for him. He enrolled in school. He got along well with his uncle. And then his uncle passed away tragically, still when Matthew was a boy. So Matthew had to begin supporting himself. He started working as a dishwasher, and he really didn't get much school finished. And when he was 12, he actually decided that he would go to sea. Matthew Henson always had a very adventurous spirit. He was very passionate about seeing the world, seeing as much as he could. So he joined a ship as a cabin boy, and he had a very successful run. He worked for 6 years. He became very close with the captain, Captain Childs, who taught him how to read and write. He taught him a lot of seafaring techniques. So he became a great sailor. He learned a bit about navigation, and he had a good time. After the captain, who was his friend, passed away, he took a job on land, again in Washington, D.C., as a store clerk. And that's where he had another interesting encounter that would change his life. Working as a clerk for a furrier, a brash, kind of larger-than-life naval officer came into the store, and they immediately hit it off, talking about adventuring and seafaring. And that naval officer was Robert E. Peary, and he immediately hired Henson to work as his valet or assistant. They went to South America, and their adventures continued from there.
So Peary recognized in him somebody who was a fellow traveler and who knew the sea. After this trip to South America and Nicaragua, followed by a dramatic series of trips to Greenland and the North. So what do we know about Matthew Henson's role in these treks and what happened there?
Well, Peary was a naval officer, but he was very interested in exploration, and particularly of the North. And that's something that Henson found very exciting as well, almost irresistible. So the two of them launched a series of expeditions over nearly 20 years. They ended up doing 8 major expeditions. They started off kind of gradually. At first, they had to learn how to survive in the north. They learned a lot from the Inuit, which actually was a little bit different than some of the other contemporaries in the exploring world. Some of their contemporaries actually looked down on the Inuits and their technology, but they really embraced it and learned as much as they could.
Yeah, I read that Henson actually learned their language and actually had a child with an Inuit woman.
He did, yes. The Inuit often called him the Kind One because he was known for his kindness and generosity. And he did learn their language. He became an expert dog sledder. He learned a lot from them. So over the course of these expeditions, the two of them mapped much of Greenland. They found some of the islands off the north. And their ultimate quest, though, which kind of came into focus over the years, was to find the geographic North Pole.
Mm-hmm. And were they the only two who were on that trek?
No, there actually were a number of other competing expeditions, some that were legitimate, some that were people kind of exaggerating their prowess in the north. But no, it was definitely a race. It was an exciting race at the time to see who would get there first.
So, yeah, I did just Google first man to discover, quote unquote, the North Pole and saw Robert Peary, 1909, though some historians contend it was an American explorer named Dr. Frederick Cook a year before. Well, so we'll leave aside that notion of discovering a place that had probably been inhabited. But was it ever conclusively proven that Peary and Henson got there first?
No, it has not been conclusively proven. There's a number of reasons for that. The Cook expedition, most historians now think, probably did not reach the North Pole. Interestingly, Cook was a surgeon, and he actually had accompanied Henson and Peary on some of their earlier expeditions. So he was well known to them and became a bit of a rival. The final push, the 1908-1909 expedition that Peary and Henson were later credited with, it's been impossible to completely verify. Some historians do think they made it. Some think they were a bit short of it. It was compounded by very misty conditions, so they couldn't get a good read on the sun to do their measurements to see if they had truly made it. So after the expedition came back in 1909, the newspaper interviewed the team, and the story that kind of carried the day was that Henson actually had likely stepped on what they thought was the North Pole first.
Well, what was that relationship like between Peary and Henson, who, as I'm reading, they arrived with 4 Eskimos and 40 dogs. The trip had begun with something like 24 men finally reaching the North Pole. It sounds like there must have been a lot of camaraderie there.
Oh, absolutely. Henson and Peary were very close for decades. It's a little bit unclear, but there were reports at the time that there was a bit of a rift that developed between them because of the final expedition. The press immediately credited Peary with discovering the geographic North Pole. Henson felt that he, based on where his footprints were in the snow, he felt that he had actually reached the spot first, and he felt that he didn't get fair credit. Peary had always called him his first man. He said, I cannot do my expedition without him. And right before he left, he said, I will not make it to the pole without Henson.
Hmm.
So clearly they were very close. However, in his own autobiography, Henson said that on the way back on that final expedition, Peary snubbed him. He said Peary did not talk to him for days at a time, which is very unusual because they had been very close. And he reported that he had felt very hurt by that.
Well, because he stepped first on the North Pole. Did he continue his life as an explorer?
Peary continued in the exploration world. He became very interested in aviation and submarines, and he actually developed some routes for delivering mail by aircraft. Both of the men on that final expedition were in their 40s. Peary, in particular, was suffering physically. He had issues with his feet, so they decided that they did not want to do any more Arctic expeditions on the ground. But they kept involved in spirit and supporting expeditions. Shortly after the expedition, Theodore Roosevelt recommended Henson for a job at the customs office in New York. So he worked as a clerk there for a number of years.
Was he ever celebrated or acknowledged as a great explorer or the man who possibly first set foot in the North Pole?
History was not particularly kind to Henson. He did not get his fair share. He was commended privately by Theodore Roosevelt, He was heralded in certain parts of the black community. He received a number of banquets in his honor. He did not receive official recognition from the National Geographic Society for a number of years. In 1906, the Society actually presented Peary with its highest honor, the Hubbard Medal for Exploration. The Society did not award one to Henson until 2000. They did so posthumously, recognizing his important contribution and actually apologizing for the fact that his contribution had been downplayed in the years since.
Well, an untold chapter of history. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Clark Howard is a senior writer for National Geographic who wrote about African-American explorer Matthew Henson. You can see his article with a slideshow of photographs and more on Matthew Henson, all at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Long before there was any talk of the nanny state, the federal government was not so invested in making sure you were fit. This next story is about the origins of the presidential physical fitness test, and it comes to us from Brian Ballow, a backstory with the American History Guys, and it starts during World War II. Skinny woman,
in the war's first year, 50% of all the men drafted actually were rejected for service. Some for things like flat feet or bad eyesight, others because of illness, both mental and physical. But a few of those men who were rejected got slapped down because of the very shape of their bodies.
Rejection specifically for weight, for example, actually made up only 60,000 to 70,000 rejected men, which is very few. It's about 2% at the time.
This is Rachel Moran, an historian at Penn State and Miller Center National Fellow.
It's a small reason for rejection, but it becomes huge in the national imagination.
So right after World War II, this very famous doctor,
Dr. Hans Krauss,
puts together a study. He wants to know how fit American kids are compared to kids in other countries. So he takes a few thousand American kids and a few thousand European kids
and asks them all to do toe touches and things like that. And in the end, he determines that American children are incredibly unfit compared to their European competitors, and that this fitness is what he calls a menace to our security.
So Dr. Krauss is a really big deal doctor at the time. People call him the father of sports medicine. And word of his study gets back to President Eisenhower, who's already plugged into the fitness world.
Eisenhower was actually a bit of a fitness nut. He would evangelize about low-carb diets. And at one point in the White House, he actually held this playful Biggest Loser contest with a couple of his friends where they owed him money if they didn't lose weight fast enough.
And after reading Krauss's study in 1955, Eisenhower tries to hold a conference to figure out just how to get American kids more fit.
They actually have to put their conference off because Eisenhower has his heart attack.
Minor setback there. They reschedule and hold the conference the next year. And it's at this conference that they establish the President's Council on Youth Fitness. It later became the President's Council on Physical Fitness, and many other names followed. But this is the beginning of the Cold War. And so the idea of the government trying to shape people's bodies, well, it feels a little problematic, a little like communism.
It's images of Russian calisthenics being done by force that makes it so important that American calisthenics are done by choice.
And guys, who do you turn to when you want to persuade people to voluntarily choose things themselves? Of course, you turn to Madison Avenue. The President's Council teams up with the Advertising Council. These are the folks who brought you Smokey the Bear, McGruff the Crime Dog, etc., etc. And Madison Avenue delivers. They produce thousands of ads, print, TV, radio, all to convince kids that physical fitness is cool.
There are some great ones that really connect American anxiety about the Cold War with sort of anxiety about fitness. So there's a big focus on astronauts, for instance, astronauts being a great Cold War dream job for American boys. So if Captain Jim Lovell of Apollo 13 fame is standing in front of a rocket and says, any kid who wants my job will have to be in pretty good shape.
You know, we're pretty well motivated to keep in shape. I'll tell you where it gets tough, though. When you're on the road. But when you know that staying in shape and keeping healthy can make the big difference to you in the program, you do it.
If you're an American boy in Cold War culture, that's going to be a pretty appealing message.
The Fitness Council also struck gold with a musical hit, the Chicken Fat song.
Chicken Fat is a song that was composed by Meredith Willson and actually sung by Robert Preston, both of whom were Broadway stars at the time. And it's prepared in 1962, specifically for Kennedy's President's Council on Physical Fitness. And the song's about 6.5 minutes long, and it's a calisthenics song. So essentially, it's the kind of record that your school would put on the PA system, or perhaps your classroom teacher would play, and the song would admonish you to touch your toes, to do sit-ups in a sort of 6.5 minute rhythmic style.
Push up every morning, 10 times push up, starting low. Once more on the rise, nuts to the flabby guys. Go, you chicken fat, go away. Go, you chicken fat, go.
And in fact, the song managed to sell over 100,000 records its first year.
As we were finishing the interview, I had sort of a therapy moment where I confessed to Rachel, talked to her about the traumatizing experience in elementary school when we were all tested for the number of pull-ups that we could do.
Oh.
For me, the number was, yes, zero. Rachel, are Eisenhower and Kennedy's physical fitness programs to blame for that, or did I just have a sadistic gym teacher?
Oh, no, you definitely get to put your blame, actually, in this case, on Lyndon Johnson.
One of my favorite presidents. Who knew?
Well, in 1966, very much as part of the President's Council on Physical Fitness, it's his administration that's going to issue the President's Award for Physical Fitness. So while schools were in no way forced to institute these programs, essentially programming for the President's Award is going to spread slowly nationwide. Ooh. And that includes running the mile and the flexibility tests and, yes, the pull-ups.
Oh, my God.
So I tell my students that the reason they have to run the mile in high school is because we were afraid of communists. I think it's good. I think it's good to know.
Right. Don't look back. They might be gaining on you. What do you think the lasting effects of these programs that were started in the late 50s and the early 60s are today?
I think that the most interesting effects might be the handicap it's placed on government programs that might actually address fitness issues. Because fitness was set up at this Cold War moment with this extreme emphasis on limited government and individual freedoms, there's a real sense that everything has to be done through advertising. Everything has to be done by asking schools to voluntarily take up government ideas. And in the end, that means that the entire program comes off almost as a joke to some people. Mm-hmm. When I mention it, it doesn't seem like even a real function of the government. What is this President's Council? And I think it's made it very difficult for the council to do anything meaningful in the long run because it's already set up as a sort of shell of an agency. And I
Right.
think that that also has effects for Michelle Obama's Let's Move, and that I think the expectations for what government fitness and nutrition programs might do is already set.
When you feel stressed,
Rachel Moran is an historian at Penn State University and a Miller Center National Fellow.
Fitness is feeling great.
That story came to us from Brian Ballow of Backstory with the American History Guys.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is the fastest growing sport in the world. A $500 million industry built on suffering.
We're going to do what? We're going to get electrocuted? Like, that's ridiculous.
You'd want to see what my body looks like, and I am battered and blue all over. I sometimes worry that people think my husband is abusing me.
Most people, they'd be like, why would you do that? Like, why would you put yourself through that?
Obstacle course races, or OCRs, Tough Guy, Tough Mudder, The Spartan Race, and countless spin-offs. About 5 million people, more than twice the number who run marathons or half marathons combined, have waged war on their own bodies and paid for the privilege. Why? Well, that's the question that investigative journalist Scott Keneally was trying to answer while on assignment for Outside Magazine, and he became a convert. His new film is called The Rise of the Sufferfests, and it screened at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord last week. We caught up with him via Skype. Hello, Scott, and welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, Scott, were you a tough guy growing up?
Very much not so. This was a radical thing that I did several years ago. I kind of just thought it would make for a funny story, suffering and torturing myself with electricity. And so I flung myself into it. But I definitely was a bit of a softy growing up. My football coaches in high school could attest to that.
So your gateway drug was a humorous essay, then the story for Outside, leading you to Billy Wilson, a true eccentric, also known as Mr. Mouse, who originated the tough guy race. Here he is from the film, talking about what was behind it for him.
It isn't just running. We take you to the very limits of your endurance. We take you beyond the limits of your endurance, so that you take that first step into death. Believe me, that step into death tells you what a marvelous life you live.
So, Scott, what kind of steps do you take to get there? What do they put you through?
Tough Guy and also Tough Mudder, they really test you in psychological ways. There are some events like Spartan Race, which are very physically challenging events, but Tough Mudder, Tough Guy are psychologically challenging. So you have fear of heights, fear of cold water, fear of claustrophobia, fear of fire, fear of electricity, fear of tear gas. They really kind of, you know, take you far outside of your comfort zone.
I don't know. Tough Guy and Tough Mudder putting you through electricity, leaping through fire, wading through freezing cold water. I'd say that's physically challenging too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mr. Mouse's idea was picked up by Will Dean. He's a Harvard B School grad who became CEO of Tough Mudder. This resulted in a lawsuit. Who prevailed in that?
They settled it out of court. So one side didn't win, although Mr. Mouse did receive $725,000. So you can infer what you want from that.
Well, Mr. Mouse comes across as a bit of a nutter, as some call him in the film. But he's not after wealth. He doesn't use the internet. He spends tens of thousands of dollars on stamps for snail mail newsletters. So how has our screen and our social media, our digital-driven life, what does that have to do with the success of these OCRs in general?
Well, I think very much, you know, this is like the sport that social media built. Mr. Mouse had been doing Tough Guy for many, many years, and it had marginal success. I mean, there was, you know, thousands of people who towed the line each winter. But once Facebook came along, that's like when you saw the explosive growth in this industry. You know, people love sharing photos of themselves on the course. Tough Mudder was very smart in that they offered free photographs for participants that they could download and share on social media. So the growth of this is the look at me generation, you know, having their friends look at them playing war heroes on weekends.
That's one of the things you really dig into in the film, that it gives you a distinction from the rest of the people in the cubicle farm, right? You know, there's a lot of status in showing yourself diving through a fire pit. But it's also, in many ways, the cause. What did you find about that kind of connected lifestyle that feeds these kind of outrageous obstacle courses?
So we're very connected socially, but there aren't very many opportunities these days for people to really connect in offline, in real life. And I think these events like really bring people together. I think there's this need for communal experiences. And, you know, what better way than to grab 80 of your friends and head out and get muddy on a weekend to, you know, create memories that you can talk about at bars and, you know, over campfires for the rest of your life. It's, you know, it's such a helpful community. There's so many people who help people over obstacles, strangers. So I think it like fosters a sense of, you know, camaraderie and connection that is very much lacking in today's modern life.
Well, you talked to a number of people about this. I found a very perceptive read by the technology and culture writer Nicholas Carr. He talks about disconnection to selves and others in the digital world.
We're getting lots of information through our eyes, but we're kind of distanced from the world and distanced from our own sensory existence. If you look at a lot of the kind of darker science fiction scenarios of the future, a lot of them are about people being rendered passive by technology, and kind of all our needs are immediately fulfilled, but we end up feeling very unfulfilled because we're not doing anything interesting anymore. You see this going back to Huxley's Brave New World. You see it more recently with Disney's WALL-E. It reflects this sense, I think, that we deeply have that we don't want to be passive. We don't want to be separated from challenge and effort. We don't want to be distanced from the world. And yet, when you look at how we design our technology and use our technology, we're heading in exactly the direction we know is the wrong direction.
Nicholas Carr there from the film The Rise of the Sufferfests. I'm talking with the filmmaker Scott Keneally, who's done a couple of these obstacle course races himself. I like, Scott, that he ties this to anxiety about our future selves, and others who you speak to tie it to our primitive pasts, you know, that we are hardwired for fight or flight. You competed in a few of these. How did it feel to you?
I honestly feel like this, we're tapping into something in our evolutionary past. I mean, we used to have to run and jump and climb and crawl, and these are things, you know, movements that we don't have to do in modern life. I think if you look at the rise of CrossFit, you know, the functional fitness movement in general, these things are tied in. I think we're tapping into something in our past. And also even just experiencing fear is something that we don't have to do anymore, but we used to have to run from things that would want to eat us. And I think there's, you know, this longing for something that we just don't experience anymore.
So tell me about the satisfaction in that for you personally.
It felt like something I'd never really done in my life. You know, there's something that first time when I did a Tough Mudder and I stood, you know, before the electricity and I had no reference for what that might feel like. There was a real fear of taking that. And I'm seeing people drop down all around me, face planting, screaming. You know, there's a terror that I felt inside. And so this, you know, there was a real sense of achievement that I felt as I crossed through that electrical barrier. It's very hard to feel like you've accomplished anything in modern life, depending on your job. There aren't many people who build things. Everything is so automated. And I feel like, you know, you don't really get a sense of accomplishment. But when you do one of these races and you cross the finish line or you climb the rope and ring that bell, there's a real rush of excitement and there's an accomplishment and achievement that I think is really missing from people's lives. I think these events are physically challenging. They're like rituals. And when you cross through them, you are a different person. I think when you feel like you are faced with death, you become a lot more appreciative of life.
So you say that after a particularly trying and freezing cold race. Here's what your wife has to say.
I went into this little hut and there were maybe like 20 people in there in this tiny little room, all shaking like crazy, wrapped in those silver blankets. And I found Scott and he couldn't hold a cup of hot cocoa.
So that's your wife, Amber, after one of these races. Your feet were absolutely freezing. Sounds like misery. Now, Will Dean, the CEO of Tough Mudder, says, it's scary, sure, we put you through real stuff, but it's not dangerous. It's perfectly safe. Is it really?
Yeah, that's a line like in the film. He says, roller coaster is supposed to be scary. A movie can be scary, but there's nothing, you know, dangerous about a Tough Mudder. The truth is, there aren't many people who break their ankles at movie theaters. And there is some, you know, absolute risk involved.
In fact, you talked to an ER physician, I think her name is Mara Greenberg, in the film. What did she tell you about the experience? And she caused a bit of a dust-up, didn't she?
She did. She did a case series of the various injuries that occurred after a Tough Mudder. Her ER was flooded with participants. And she did a case series of all the different injuries that she encountered, and she pretty much steered me away from doing any electrical obstacles.
Tell me more about this electrical obstacles. You get shocked?
Yeah, it's like 10,000 volts. I'm not sure, you know, what that actually... It feels like you're getting stung by bees, or it's not very pleasant. But ultimately, it's probably not that harmful. I think some people have had bad reactions to it, but overall, I think it's probably a safe obstacle.
Well, you don't only talk to super fans or devotees, but a number of skeptics, you know, who ask, you know, what's next? Poison darts, you know, the machete toss, whatever, shark swims. And similar to a thought that kept coming up for me, privilege. Here is the San Francisco-based columnist and critic Mark Morford.
It is extreme privilege to say, I'm so entitled now, my life is so comfortable, that I'm going to pay you now to have this done to me and in a controlled environment and experience what all these other people experienced in a much harsher way, that I get to experience it just a little taste in a safe environment, like a Disney version of real life. What is that? What are you really saying? Like, cool, tear gas me a little bit. Oh, that's what they experience, those poor people out there in the street. Wow, thank God I'm not a minority.
That's something that kept coming up for me, Scott. You know, the kind of warlike metaphors that are used, the killing field, a taste of hell. When there are refugees suffering from exposure on flimsy boats, or Syrians getting bombed, protesters getting tear gassed and tortured, isn't this a kind of twisted form of play?
Yeah, and, you know, Hannah Rosen, it didn't make the final cut, but she said that she grew up in Israel where military service was, you know, just kind of the back, you know, Tough Mudder was the background of your life over there, and that she didn't think Tough Mudder would hold any appeal in Israel. And I think, you know, this is certainly appeals to a privileged sect of people who live these safe sort of lives. And I think if our lives were more challenging, we wouldn't have to do this. I think it's a symptom of, you know, a society that's out of step. And it also is an antidote. I think it scratches that itch for people.
Another criticism actually came from one of my colleagues, Taylor Quimby. He's done a couple of Tough Mudders. He thinks it's suffering from its own popularity and the kind of commercial gimmickry. First time he did it was really challenging. Next one, not so challenging. And there were so many people he had to wait 15 minutes for each person to slog through each obstacle. Do you think that the success of the OCRs is running away from it?
I'm a little torn on this. I mean, I think Tough Mudder was definitely more challenging when I first started. There's really no question about that. But I also believe that it's important to bring people off the couch and into this world. So if they dampen it down a little bit or tone it down, or the hills aren't as steep, but we're getting more people into the sport, I think it's a good thing. I think the more the merrier. I want everyone to do this.
Well, I was inspired, I have to admit. It was really something to watch people's individuals' transformation, including your own. And we've talked a lot about those kind of social deficits, but there are a lot of stories of people overcoming personal deficits. You yourself, you set yourself a challenge when your wife got pregnant. What has it done for you as a person, a father, a man?
I don't want to say that I'm, you know, twice the man I used to be, but I definitely feel more capable and competent as a person. These events give me something to train for. Whereas, you know, in years past, I would maybe get really excited for mountain bike season and I would go gung ho and train and bike a lot. And then I'd do nothing for the next 8 months. The great thing about obstacle course racing is there's events all throughout the year that you can train for. So it keeps me fit. And also I'm a bit of a CrossFit devotee at this point. I love like the communal aspect of it, the shared suffering. So I'm definitely a different person now than I was before I started this journey. And I feel much more capable as a man.
Well, it comes across. Scott Keneally, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Scott Keneally is the writer and director behind Rise of the Sufferfest, which is available for download on iTunes beginning next month. You can learn more about the film at wordofmouthradio.org. Not to be outdone, Word of Mouth and Outside In producer Molly Donahue suffered considerably less this weekend picking blueberries. She and her mom gathered 18 pounds in 40 minutes. They're planning to make jam and the family favorite Kuchen, but are open to hear your old standbys and innovative recipes. You can post them on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or send us a tweet at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth here on NHPR.